right. Welcome back, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started with our next session. So at this time, we would like to go ahead and thank our generous sponsors of the School for Successful Ranching for their support of this program and commitment to producer education. There are small displays set up in the hallway on this floor, and we ask that you visit their booths in the expo and say thank you for everything they do. We couldn't do this program without them. Our sponsors include Capital Farm Credit, Cattlemen's Education Series, Corteva, Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo, Lone Star Ag Credit, Positive Feeds, Rabbit Agrifinance, Stay Tough Fence Manufacturing, and Texas Beef Quality Assurance. Our next presentation is Three Keys to Prickly Pear Control, presented by Dr. Charlie Hart with Corteva, James Jackson with Texas A&M AgriLife Extension, and Dr. Morgan Treadwell with Texas A&M AgriLife Extension. Please join me in welcoming our speakers.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to kick this thing off. I'm sure everybody needs some stretching. I'm going to ask, see what, how much diversity we have in this room. How many of you have never heard of prickly pear? That's a trick question. How many of you have prickly pear and deal with it? Yeah, exactly. Prickly pear is really a unique plant. We could sit here and talk all day long about just prickly pear. Just the uniqueness of it from a metabolism standpoint and how it operates internally, if you will. It's a really interesting plant. But what we're going to focus on today is really the management of that plant. And in particular, we're going to hone in a little more on chemical application. What does it take to kill prickly pear? Okay. So when we talk about prickly pear, there's all kinds of prickly pear out there, isn't there? This is some of the taller variety that we have down in South Texas. So there's tall varieties, there's short varieties, there's little really short varieties with really short thorns or really short glochids. Purple varieties of prickly pear out there. I think I skipped one. Very short varieties, thick varieties, and mixed varieties. You can see multiple varieties of prickly pear just in that one picture. So when we talk about prickly pear, the good thing is there's about 25, depending on who you talk to, 25 to 30 different varieties of prickly pear in Texas. The bottom line is when it comes to management, we really manage them all the same from a chemical standpoint, okay? There's some differences that you'll see based on some of these keys that we have, how to make it successful, but it really doesn't matter quite so much which species or which variety of prickly pear you have, okay? That's the good thing about this. There's all kinds of different crossbreeding in these. You have yellow-flowered varieties, you have orange-flowered varieties, and you have orange and yellow-flowered varieties on the same plants because of this crossbreeding with these plants. The interesting thing about prickly pear, though, is that when that cladode, as we call it, or pad, falls off the ground, what does it do? It roots, right? And guess what it does? It actually makes a clone of the plant that it fell off of, okay? So not in structure, but in size of the pads and the length of the thorns and things like that are all going to be clonal to the parent that it fell off of. So just one of the interesting things about it. But it is extremely difficult to identify. It can react not only to crossbreeding, but it can react to environmental changes. You can take the same subspecies and put it in two different environmental conditions, and over time, it's going to adapt to that. It can change in growth form, spine number, flower color, all kinds of things. It does cover a very large range from East Texas to West Texas and North Texas to South Texas. So it's pretty much all over Texas. It can reproduce, like we talked about, vegetatively, where the pad falls off on the ground and makes another plant, or by seed. It can be either one. Those seeds move down over the landscape with water or something else, and it can spread that way. How else can a seed spread? Through an animal, right? Animals come in and eat it, and then they spread it through when they defecate around the pasture. They spread the seeds as well. Javelinas, prickly pear is probably the number one diet for in the diet, number one for javelinas, raccoons. Believe it or not, raccoons love those things. Have you ever seen raccoon scat with a bunch of purple and seeds in it? That's prickly pear seed. Okay, so it does get spread around. We talked about the ability for this plant to sprout from the ground. As soon as it hits that ground, if it gets the right moisture and the right temperature, it will resprout, take root, and clone the plant that it fell off of. So what are the issues? There's good things and there's bad things about prickly pear, right? We've all heard about quail habitat and quail nesting and things like that. Some prickly pear may not be bad, but what is the problem with prickly pear? Well, it does take space, right? It takes space on your landscape, and the more pear you have, the more space it takes. It's that simple. Which in turn doesn't necessarily so much reduce forage production, but it keeps the animals from getting to the forage, right? So it reduces access to that forage. It discourages grazing for the most part. There's some animals that you've seen with their noses full and snouts full of spines, and they've learned to just deal with it, and they go ahead and eat it anyway. Once you develop a pear-eating animal, they're probably going to be a pear-eating animal. And they're going to always have tongue problems, and they're always going to have problems with their nose and things like that. The interesting thing about it is that it is one of the few plants that we have that actually increases in a drought. The density of prickly pear actually increases in a drought, okay? And it has been recorded that in favorable growing conditions, it can increase biomass as much as 25% to 30% in a single year. Okay, so it has the ability to quickly become a problem. When maybe it's not a problem right now, it could very quickly become one down the road. Now, who would disagree that the prickly pear is too thick in that pasture? Probably all of us, right? Who would disagree with me? They want their prickly pear that thick. Obviously, some prickly pear is not a bad thing. We all pretty much agree that when it gets to a certain point, it's probably time to do something about it. Years ago, right? Really, years ago, before you get to this. I'm not sure a mouse could get through that type of prickly pear, right? Certainly not cattle are not going to go in there. Deer are probably not going to frequent that very much if they don't have to. So we do kind of agree that when it gets to this point, it's probably way too bad. But what about less dense prickly pear? How about this picture? Is this too much prickly pear? Is it okay prickly pear? Or what is it? Well, one of the things that we have to remember is that, as we said, prickly pear takes up an area of land, right? And so if you look at that picture, what do you see in that picture? You see that the cattle came in there, and the grass in the inner space is a lot shorter than the grass that's inside the prickly pear. So effectively, if we have a 100-acre pasture and it's 50% covered in prickly pear, and we're stocked in it for a 100-acre pasture, we're double overstocked, right? We've got twice as many animals out there because it comes back to grazable acres. Where those prickly pear are not grazable acres, and it forces the animals to graze more in the interspace between those. Okay, so keep that in mind when you think about the density. If you're seeing places like this to where you're starting to see the animals have higher impact on the interspaces between your prickly pear plants, you're probably at the point where you really need to start doing something because you're losing grazable acres. Okay. I don't think anybody would argue that this is probably not a very good situation either. When you take prickly pear and you throw brush on top of that, then it just compounds the problem. How many of you can see much grass in that picture? Well, there's not much moisture left for grass, right? So we have to take that into consideration as well. What other kinds of brush species are out there and things like that? So when it comes to prickly pear management, we do have different methods we can use. Mechanical, fire, and herbicide are basically three. 9 times out of 10, you're probably better off to use multiple instead of just one over time. There's no silver bullet out there, and there's nothing that's going to solve your problem in one application, whether that's chemical, fire, or mechanical. There's always maintenance that needs to be done, follow-up, and things like that, whether it's prickly pear or other brush species, okay? So we're going to talk about the herbicide today, And we're going to talk a little bit about some aerial and ground broadcast trials and a little bit about some individual plant treatment trials in a minute. But what are the three keys to prickly pear? Finally, we get to the purpose of this talk, right? The three keys, number one, is the application timing and the plant condition. Okay, we've got to get that product out at the right time and under the right conditions. Coverage, coverage, coverage. If we don't get the herbicide to the prickly pear, we don't do a good job killing it. Okay, and we'll talk some more about these. And then the herbicide options. So when to spray prickly pear? So the recommendation right now in 1466, which is, if you will, the Bible for chemical control on rangelands, says late summer or fall applications. How many of you spray in the winter or early spring? Probably most of us, right? But the actual application in the notes says late summer or fall applications are actually the best. Okay, so why do we spray in the spring? It really says any time of year, but the best time is here. But if we have other brush species, if we have live oaks that we want to limit the damage to, that's when we switch to aerially spraying in the winter or early spring. Before we get leaves on the trees, and it all goes back to that coverage. We've got to be able to get that herbicide to the plant, okay? Everybody is pretty much in tune with this. Most people try to get all their pear spraying done before they put leaves on mesquite trees, and there's a reason for that. But if you don't have mesquite trees, you're actually better off probably to wait for a late summer, early fall application if you don't have brush that is keeping the canopy covered and keeping you from being able to get down to the prickly pear. So keep that in mind when you think about when to spray. Condition, okay? We know that a damaged prickly pear, unlike when we treat mesquite, a damaged prickly pear is actually easier to kill, okay? The exception to that are these types of things. When we get these funguses and molds and spores on these plants that causes this rust looking on the plant, that is going to inhibit uptake of the herbicide because we can't get through that stuff, okay? So if you have a situation where you have a lot of prickly pear that just doesn't look healthy because of these natural rusts and funguses and things, then we need to think about that in terms of letting the plant get over that before we do any application. How many of you have seen the gray fungus that's on it? You can kind of see some of those pads growing out of it, and if I zoom in, that middle pad there in the middle has that gray fungus on it. Again, that's just an outside coating on that pad that makes it twice as hard to get herbicide into it, okay? So if you spray during that time of year, when the plant is in that condition, you're probably not going to get as much herbicide into that plant as you would if it was one of those that was greener and doesn't have that on it, okay? So coverage, 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 an important factor. And probably, in my opinion, the most important factor, regardless of the herbicide, is getting the spray to the prickly pear plant, okay? So let's talk about grass coverage, right? If we have so much grass coverage that the grass is standing up above the prickly pear, that grass is going to intercept a lot of that spray. And it's going to be hard to get that spray to the prickly pear. So my rule of thumb is if I can stand sideways and look out, and I can't see very much prickly pear, but I walk out in the pasture and they're everywhere, that's telling me there's too much grass out there to be spraying. You need to do something before you spray to get that grass down. Either graze it down, burn it down, something, okay? You've got to be able to get to the pear. With the taller pear, what happens is the outer crown, inside crown, sticks out above the grass. But if you look, a lot of times the side of that plant is kind of tucked up under the grass, and we do a great job killing the center out of that prickly pear, and then the outside pads remain alive because they were protected by the grass, okay? So we've got to do what we can to help in terms of exposing that prickly pear. Other brush species, short, tall, weed species, things like that, anything that's going to intercept that spray can affect how much you get to that plant, okay? even with individual plant treatment, we talk about coverage. And if you look at that picture, you can see the plant that he's spraying. Those plants that you see in the background are actually kind of buried down in the grass. And it would be very tough to get herbicide from an aerial standpoint into those types of plants, okay? Without doing something ahead of time to prepare for your aerial application, okay? So for IPT, that's why we talk about apply that spray to both sides of the pad. Get both sides if you can, because it's all about coverage, even with IPT, okay? So options. Right now there's Tordon 22K and Surmount that have been around for years, and the new herbicide Mesaview. And so what I would like to do is now is I'm going to turn it over to a couple of our Texas A&M friends that have been involved in some of the research trials recently, their research trials in terms of looking at the different herbicide options and be able to help you compare those as well so you can decide which option is best for you. James Jackson, I'm going to introduce both of these, and then I'll have them come up here individually. But James Jackson is going to go first. James is going to talk about broadcast options, both aerial and ground broadcast options for prickly pear. James is an extension program specialist with Texas A&M out of Stephenville, Texas A&M AgriLife Extension. And then Morgan Treadwell. Morgan is going to talk to us about the individual plant treatment and some of the results that she's seen from her herbicide trials. And Morgan is an extension range specialist, also an assistant professor there with Texas A&M AgriLife Extension, and she is in the San Angelo field office. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to James and let him cover the broadcast.
Okay, well, good afternoon. Well, thank you very much, Charlie. Okay, as Charlie said, my name is James Jackson. I've got an office in Stephenville, but I spend quite a bit of time running up and down the roads, working with county extension agents and landowners. But what we're going to talk about for the next few minutes is broadcast control prickly pear options. You know, we have a couple of standard rule of thumb whenever we start talking about when is it time to think, let's move above an IPT application. You know, we know from listening to the economist and doing the math that once that plant density exceeds 300 to 400 plants to the acre, you're better off to spray the whole area. The cost of IPT and prickly pear will be greater than what it will cost to spray that entire area. Now, I give you a range, 300 to 400 plants to the acre. Depending on what herbicide you select, what applicator you're going to utilize, if you're going to ground broadcast it, aerial broadcast it, that exact number will change a little bit, so it will vary. However, let's talk about some ground broadcasting. Say you have a small area. Let's say you have a 200-acre pasture and you got 50 acres that's really been abused in the past and really thick prickly pear. Probably don't want to put an airplane in the air, and good luck finding an airplane to target that small of an area. But with that, we can still see some really good results utilizing ground broadcast. You got a large area, rough terrain. You know, part of my extension areas are around the hill country, Brady, going over to Goldthwaite. There's a lot of prickly pear sprayed in that area. How many of y'all would have a ground application rig y'all drive through the hill country? Not going to happen, is it? So, you know, aerial broadcast is a quick way to increase the grazable acres. As Charlie said, it really limits the real estate. It occupies that real estate that could be better utilized for growing grass in your livestock operation. Most economical methods for treatments of large areas. You know, we kind of started talking about that with the 300 to 400 plants to the acre. Broadcast is cheaper way of treating prickly pear if you have the right density in a big enough area. So coverage, Charlie Hart talked about this quite a bit, but I'm going to talk about it a little bit more because I've been on some of these jobs. I've seen some complaints people have. And they're like, well, we sprayed the prickly pear and never did die. Well, mesquite canopy, Charlie talked about that quite a bit. You know, we always talk about spraying when those mesquites are dormant. Tall grass. You know, I was talking to some guys earlier today that are up in that tall grass part of Texas, up around Wichita Falls, Henrietta. You got all that little blue stem up there with the tall grasses. If your grass is waist high and your prickly pear is ankle high, what's going to happen? What are you going to spray? Take a guess. The grass. Spray volume. You know, typically high GPA is better coverage, and we're going to dive more into this later on. But I always like to sum all this up with what you don't cover, you can't control. Okay, we're going to look at a little bit about ground broadcast applications. I've got a few rigs right there. These are rigs that I utilize for spraying test plots. Got some that go on the back of a Kawasaki mule, another one with a four-wheeler. But typically, some standard rules of ground broadcast prickly pear control. 10 to 20 gallons to the acre. If you can, at 20 gallons, you'll get a little bit better coverage. 10 gallons would be the minimum. Anytime we're doing any type of ground broadcast spraying, and if you're using a boom, you owe to that boom 12 to 18 inches above the target reed. We also know that if you look at the 10-day forecast, you see rain coming on a Friday, you'd be very smart and you'd look like you did a really good job if you spray before the rain. You know, what will happen is we'll get some rain, we'll get a new flux of growth. That prickly pear will move that herbicide around within the plant. And your prickly pear control job will look extremely well. So, now let's talk a little bit more about some herbicide options. We're going to start out by looking at what all we put in the tank. Methylated seed or non-ionic surfactant. You need to pick one or the other, methylated seed or NIS. You can buy those at many various ag herbicide retailers. Medium to coarse droplet size. We always say over and over again, if you're going to broadcast spray anything, you got to calibrate it. You need to know what you're putting out. You know, as Dr. Hart mentioned, we got the old Tordon 22K, trait picloram. That's the recommended rate, 32 ounces to the acre. Then you have Surmount, 2 quarts to the acre, 64 ounces. And then a product that I've been looking at for the past 5-6 years that's a very good product, it is the MazorView. And we're going to look a little bit more at some of these results here in a minute. So here are some ground broadcast studies that we've had the opportunity to do over the years. And I like to describe this as playing the limbo. We were trying to identify how low we could go with this herbicide and still get an acceptable rate of mortality. So, of course, we had to compare it to the two standards, Tordon and Surmount. And then you can see we did an 8-ounce rate, a 16-ounce rate, 24, and so on. We did studies throughout the area. You see those were two sites right there at Mills in Eastland County, then one down around Sonora. Here is the data that we got. As you can see right here, these are those box and whiskle charts. And I know not everybody looks at this stuff every day like I do. But one thing that you can get is the wider, the longer that box is, the more variability among these treatments. So if you look at the blue box, that's the Mesa View at 32 ounces, according to the acorn. The green is the surmount at 64. But what I also want you to take note of is up at the very top of that slide. Look right there, 12 months after treatment. How many of you in the past have sprayed with surmount? Then the question is, it really doing anything? You spray, you think, I sprayed it, it should be dying, and it's not dying. And then you wait another year, and it's still not dying quick enough to please you. This right here was done at 1 year after treatment. And what you can see, at 1 year out, we're getting right around 75 to 85% control. That's pretty quick for prickly pear mortality. If you look at the surmount and tordon, it's getting there, but more variability. And also, if you look at the low rates of Mesa View. So if you see that rate, there was a lot of science that went in, a lot of research that went into developing that recommendation for a rate. Here are some pictures of some of these sites that I took. This one right there is in Eastland. And there's a few things I want to point out with this picture. One is, if you look right here in this treated area, you'll see quite a bit of prickly pear left. But also, take a look at the untreated. If we have an area like this, and let's say we kill 80% of the prickly pear, 20% of prickly pear is still a pretty good bit when you started out with a closed canopy. So, while we would like to see it look a little bit cleaner, and I expect this will with some coming time, we still did a really good job opening up a lot of grazable acres. And that's what I'm trying to get across to you. Yes, we left a little bit, but we're doing a lot of good. This is a site around Goethright. This site looked awesome. If you look at this site right here, you'll see one little green pad right there. Look at that untreated area. How much grass was accessible that was right up in here? Extremely little. You know, we opened up a lot of area, grew a lot more grass. And I suspect this little one right here, and I go back and do the 2-year evaluation, I suspect that'll probably be dead. But what I always tell people, prickly pear is an extremely slow growing plant. Well, guess what that makes it? A slow dying plant. Okay, now let's talk a little bit about aerial broadcast. We started down at the ground, and now we're moving up in the air. Dad always told me the only job you could start out with at the top was driving T-post. So I had to tell y'all now we're moving on up. Okay, rules for area broadcast. Minimum for GPA, 4 gallons to the acre. You know, there's some applicators going around doing more than that. That's okay. But whatever you do, if you're going to broadcast spray prickly pear, talk to that pilot and make sure they do the minimum. If they do a little bit more, say thank you. You know, every half mesquite spray in their dormant season. If oak trees are present, from some research that we've done, and I'm going to show you the data here in a little bit, if you can spray before that oak tree puts on new leaves, that's another benefit. Something else I'm going to say, talk to some people, find a well-known, respectable applicator. There's a lot of helicopter applicators out there. There's a lot of good ones. Talk to some guys, find a good one, and go on. Then after that, you got to find a herbicide. Once again, the same herbicide options. Once again, use a surfactant. Okay, we have a lot of ground broadcast sites, and I'm going to show you a few different data slides. One right here has three sites that were sprayed in February and March of 2017. And these right here are sites with prickly pear and live oak trees. Each site had fall treatments with these test plots. We were doing a 10-acre test plot. They were done by a few different applicators. So one applicator was doing full GPA, the other one was doing 5. And then we were doing evaluations pretty frequently, 4, 8, 12, and 24 months out. Here's the protocol that we were looking at. And I apologize, we're going to get back to the oak tree data. But this right here was a slide I voted to show you and I threw in at the last minute. This right here is a lot of broadcast sites. And this also takes into account ground and aerial broadcast. If we look right here, the green is the mesa view. The blue is the tordon. You can see that they're both killing prickly pear. They're both doing a good job of killing prickly pear. This is 2 years out. But what you can also see is the mesa view is a little bit more consistent. And it's bumping 85 to about 78% control. Whereas the tordon is about 75 down to 55. So getting some kill off of both of them. But you can see that one's a little bit better. Okay, now we're going to look at three sites. And this is some other data. And one thing I want to talk about here is anytime you do broadcast applications, you have variants. You have a lot of variations among the treatments. You have plots that are 10 acres in size with oak trees with different soil types. It's not a very controlled environment. So right here we have three sites, and you can see we had a 24-ounce rate, and look at how much variance we had right there. And keep in mind, this is also only at 1 year after treatment. So I expected all these boxes to tighten up quite a bit. But something else I want to point out is the mesa view. The 32-ounce rate is the most consistent at a year out. The tordon looks okay, not quite as good as the surmount. It's doing pretty good, but also keep in mind that's 64 ounces to the acre compared to half of that. Okay, we were talking about oak trees. You know, we know that there's some areas of Texas. I like to think of the areas like down around Brady, up around Graham, that have a lot of oak trees. Lots of landowners really are proud of their oak trees. And I understand, I like an oak tree too. And lots of these landowners in the past have been very hesitant about spraying prickly pear for fear that they may injure their oak trees. So what we did, we had three sites. These sites were done down around Sonora and Brady, Texas, where we looked for a site that had oak trees but also prickly pear. I had to look long and hard to find a landowner who would let me do this. I went around talking to people, hey, I really need a site to test some herbicides at, but I may do a little bit of oak tree defoliation, maybe something like that. Finally, I found a guy down around Brady. His ranch manager said, we got plenty of oak trees. If you can thin them out, that'd be great. I said, you're the guy I need. So, right here we have oak trees at 4 months, 8 months, and 12 months after treatment. What you can see is any herbicide we sprayed did significant damage to the oak trees. Let's just go ahead and get that out of the way. However, if we average all the sites together, A year out, the maize of you had 6% oak tree damage. If we look at the percent recovery, the sorghum had 47% recovery, 64%, and then 82% recovery. Can anybody walk up to an oak tree and say, that looks like 6% canopy defoliation? It's pretty tough to do. What we would do is you'd have a group of guys out in your pasture looking up at the oak trees. Okay, that oak tree looks like it has 10%. We move to another one. Okay, that oak tree is 40%. Then we average them all out, and that's what we got. So to me, that's exciting. That's a positive advancement in technology with this new herbicide, that we were able to still maintain excellent control of the prickly pear, and we were softer on the live oak trees. This right here is a map of where those two sites were at. If you're not familiar with the state of Texas, that's kind of the hill country, the western edge. Lots of live oaks, lots of prickly pear. Here are some pixels. This right here is Sorghum Out. You can see this tree right here was located on the plot line. You can look at what we did to those oak trees. Pretty significant damage. If you're a landowner attached to the oak trees, that may worry you a little bit. There was the Tordon. Still, we set 90% canopy reduction on that. And then that's the maize of you. It's a little bit softer on the oak tree, 70%. But let's go ahead and say 70% still a lot of damage when we're talking about oak tree defoliation. Okay, that is what that site looks like at 17 months after treatment. If you look right here, you'll see some prickly pear. Or you'll see what's left of some prickly pear. Then look at these oak trees. So everything, all in all, looks pretty good, accomplished the goal. To sum this stuff up right now, let's talk a little bit about the ground broadcast. Throughout the studies that we conducted, the maize of you at 42 ounces was more consistent than Sorghum Out. And it was also a little bit higher than Tordon 22K. The aerial control, the maize of you at 32 ounces was equal to control as of the Sorghum Out or the Tordon. The oak tolerance, though, the maize of you defoliated the trees equal, but the recovery with the maize of you was a lot better than what we saw with the Sorghum Out or the Tordon 22K. And I also want to emphasize this last point right here. You know, you see those commercials, no animals were harmed in making of this. No oak trees were harmed in conducting these tests or killed. Yes, we did harm them. Yes, we did knock the leaves off of them. But if we go back to those sites, I have not been able to find a dead oak tree. And I've looked plenty hard. So to me, that's a very positive point of view. Okay, now I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Morgan Treadwell out of San Angelo, and she's going to talk about individual plant treatment.
Thank you, James. Like James said, my name is Morgan Treadwell. I'm the range extension specialist in San Angelo, and it's fun to be in Fort Worth. This Cattle Rangers Convention is probably one of my most favorite conferences to attend, so thank you for having us. James and I started working on Mesaview probably around 2015, or with James maybe even a little bit earlier. And it's not very often that as a range specialist you get to see a product from its infancy all the way to its completion. And so we have just recently added Mesaview into our ERM 1466, as Dr. Hart referred to as the Bible for chemical weed and brush control. And so it's really excited to be a part of that. And with working with Texas A&M, or for Texas A&M AgriLife Extension, we get to work with a lot of neat companies who are really invested in innovation and delivering the very best tools for our landowners. And so our relationship with Corteva Agriscience is a great example of that. And like I said, it's been really exciting to work with this product and to see it in action from start to finish. So I get to cover IPT, or individual plant treatment. That's probably one of the fastest ways to really see a difference. With IPT, of course, you have a little bit higher assurance that your coverage is really complete and consistent. And as you know, us as millennials, we always like to see instantaneous results. But all of you in this room probably would like to see that from a prickly pear perspective. And so we'll get into what we're looking at from an IPT perspective. So these graphs are set up very similar to how James had his graph set up. We have percent mortality on the y-axis, and then also the mortality rating for each of these Mesaview rates. Now, this is all IPT, but we've got different rates at 0.8% and 1.2%. The reason for that being is this was one of our very first trials looking at IPT. And so we wanted to see how Mesaview would hold up to the standard controls of Surmount and Tordon 22K. That was our first question, to really even see if there was anything promising here. And so this is looking at it from 12 months after treatment, 1 year after application. These are data averaged across 9 different sites, so including James's territory, which is by Stephenville, and then, of course, including my territory out of San Angelo. I go as far west as pretty much El Paso these days and as far east as Lampasas. And so, of course, as you know, Texas, there is not one single predictable or dependable year. Year after year, we always are dealt a different hand of cards in terms of environmental conditions. And so this is taking all of that variability that is across Texas, across plant communities, across precipitation regimes, and averaging them into a complete data set. And so as we see here, Mesaview, that's demonstrated in the red, at that 1.2%, 1 year after treatment, we're already achieving 90% mortality on our prickly pear. And of course, that's compared to the 1% rate of Surmount and the 1% rate of Tordon 22K. Again, notice the variability that exists when using Surmount and Tordon 22K. Just a little bit more inconsistencies when we're comparing that to this new product called Mesaview. Taking that same data set, those 9 sites, and looking at it now from a 2 years after application response. And 2 years is pretty typical when we really start to see, okay, what was effective in kind of that long-term side of things. So 2 years is when we really start to feel confident in talking about those mortality rates. And we can see that same rate of Mesaview at 1.2% goes all the way up to 100%. In fact, on some of these sites, it's really difficult to even tell what was sprayed because that prickly pear is very difficult to find. In fact, on my Mesaview plots, I've started actually tagging my prickly pear individuals. That way I know what's been sprayed and what hasn't. After that two-year mark, or around that two-year mark time, it's difficult to find them. That's how quickly this thing moves. So 24 months after treatment, we can see Mesaview at probably an average of 97%. Compared to Surmount at about 88%, and then, of course, Tordon 22K at 70%. Again, a little bit tighter control and tighter consistency with that Mesaview. What we've also been seeing, too, and when Dr. Hart gave me this protocol in this trial, he said, well, the fun part about this is you got to go look at your prickly pear every 4 months. And I said, you got to be kidding me, really? You want me to look at something every 4 months just to see if there's been a difference? Now, keep in mind, my experience up to this point was strictly with Surmount and Tordon 22K. And with those products, not much change happens within that four-month time frame, right? Well, with Mesaview, I probably could have even went out there at a two-month time interval and have seen a lot of different changes. So this is an example of some of that change that we've seen in a rather short period of time. This is a time-lapse just a time-lapse picture sequence showing how quickly Mesaview can work after a January application rate. So those first pictures that you see on the left, that was the day of application toward the end of January. By April, Meadowview, you can see a lot of yellowing is starting to occur within that short time frame of 4 months after treatment. Whereas the Tordon 22K, it looks pretty similar to how it looked in January. Not much has changed since then. You get into July, and already 7 to 8 months after treatment, you're looking at dead pear. And this is when I started thinking I need to start tagging these prickly pear individuals because they're getting harder and harder to find. And as I said earlier, as a millennial, you're all about the instantaneous results. But as everyone in this room can attest to when killing pear, it's really fun to see all of your hard work and efforts paid off that soon after application. So pretty exciting stuff. This gets even more fun. This is a video looking again at that time-lapse sequence of prickly pear. And again, this was applied in January. We've got Tordon 22K on the left, Meadowview on the right. And as we get into that February, March, and April, again, notice how quickly that yellowing starts to occur. You start to slowly see those pear pads fall over. And then into some of that desiccation that it can occur as early as 8 months after treatment. Again, it's nothing compared to what we see with Tordon 22K. It's like watching the most boring episode of your favorite TV show and then all of a sudden getting into the Die Hard movie series. It's a completely different feel of what you're looking at from a prickly pear standpoint. And you don't have to be a rangeland manager to appreciate that. I think everyone in this room can really tell that difference. So this is, again, looking at Meadowview, but after we notice that it can hold up to our standards of surmount and Tordon 22K, our question started to change a little bit. That's when we got interested in playing with the different rates of Meadowview. We're always out for efficiency. How efficient can we be with how much product and how much mortality? And as James said earlier, it's kind of a balancing act. You got to be able to find that sweet spot of mortality in terms of how much product or active ingredient you're using. And so this is still looking at Meadowview compared to Surmount and Tordon 22K, but we're looking at different rates. And this is where I really enjoyed this part of the research because we're getting into the strategies and developing the tools and the recommendations for folks like you, for landowners, to really start to effectively use something like this. So this is data, again, averaged across 6 sites from pretty much all across the state of Texas, taking into every single variability of different sites and different plant communities. Meadowview at 4 different rates, so a 0.25% rate, a 0.5% rate, 0.75% rate, and then the full 1% rate. Now, Meadowview at 1% is a pretty straight line comparison to Surmount at 1% and Tordon 22K at 1% as well. And so Meadowview is still in those blue bars, or Meadowview at 1% is at still at that blue bar area, and you can kind of see that 1% rate is that area where we would call it the sweet spot, right? We've got a really high, consistent amount of mortality across all 6 sites, and this is only 12 months after application. And so you can see we're right there from that 90 to maybe even 95 or 96% mortality compared to our other standards of Surmount at 1%, and then, of course, Tordon 22K at 1%. So lots of variability in that Tordon, but we are able to tighten that up and improve our overall consistency and effectiveness with the Meadowview at 1%. I think as a range manager, pictures are always worth 1,000 words. So I could stand up here and tell you all about this data and show you all these colorful graphs, but pictures, I think, sometimes tell a better story than what I ever could. So these are pictures off of my research sites, again, near that San Angelo area. This is in Tom Green County. This is on the left, we've got Meadowview at 1% 4 months after treatment. And then that same rate of Meadowview, 1%, 8 months after treatment. And this is that crazy tall pear that should be growing in South Texas, but we found it instead in Tom Green County. Again, seeing this type of control and speed of yellowing is really, really pretty neat, just as a range manager to see what can happen in that short period of time. This is just a comparison of Mesoview 1% 8 months after treatment compared to an untreated buffer zone. So between these two PVC pipes is untreated prickly pear. So you can see how healthy it was. You can see it's kind of that taller, bigger, thicker pear. And then, of course, the treated pear on the right-hand side looks a heck of a lot better, in my opinion, than that buffer zone strip. This is a site in Scurry County right outside of Snyder. We've got this picture shows a comparison of Mesoview at 1% on the right to Tordon 22K 1% on the left. And so, again, a different site, a different plant community, but that prickly pear response is still the same and still holding up across different sites and different rangeland conditions. This was taken in Runnels County outside of Ballinger. Again, this is comparing Mesoview 1% to an untreated prickly pear colony that's in between a buffer zone. You can see those two PVC pipes right there. And this is 4 months after treatment. This was definitely one site where I was like, man, I got to get out there and tag those. I need to be able to remember where the prickly pear was that I sprayed. But just the sheer response and how fast we were able to kill this prickly pear is pretty cool. That's all I have for you today. Our relationship with Corteva is really cool just because we get to do really neat science. And James Jackson has done a lot more of this work too. So if you have any questions, I'm just going to default to him. But really appreciate your time. And yes, we'll open it up for questions.
Yeah, we've got time for questions. James up here too. So we have one. Yes, ma'am.
Excellent question. If everybody didn't hear that, she's asking about the results stand for themselves, which you're saying, but what's the cost difference? And the answer to that is you're going to have Tordon is going to be your cheapest cost per acre, period. Mesoview is going to be in the middle, and Surmount is going to be the highest. Okay? So there's absolutely no reason why you would want to use Surmount at a higher cost per acre but not do any better, right? You do get a value for the increase in Mesoview over Tordon. Does that make sense? Okay. So, yes. What's the smallest packaging? That's a very good question. Up till about a week ago, a 30-gallon drum was as small as you can get. Now we have 1-gallon containers. They are shipping as we speak. They should be in the retail stores, if not now, within the week. There'll be 1-gallon containers coming in a 4x1-gallon case. Restricted. It is a restricted use pesticide. All three of these herbicides are restricted use pesticides. If you're looking for a pesticide that is not restricted for prickly pear control, we have a product called PastureGuard HL, and it does just about as good, but the price point is going to be even higher than Surmount, okay? But it's the only option we have that is unrestricted. You don't have to have a license, okay? Yes, sir.
I've got a question. If this is a restricted herbicide, and it got out so fast and got it on the market, how come we could still not get MAC 28 if it messed with that in a 12 years or other species of
rough? Well, yeah. No, it's a good point. The Mesoview is actually a combination of three different products that are already in the market in other places. Okay, so we didn't have to go to EPA for anything except a label approval. Okay, so I can't speak to MAC 28 because it's not ours. But that's
available other places like Canada or the United States for the highway use, but not ag use. Yes, I'll talk on that briefly for 1 minute. Being that I'm with A&M Extension, I work with a lot of various companies, and the aminocyclopyrrolol, that's the active ingredient, It is labeled for use in IVM, but it does not have a grazing tolerance. So if you are grazing any type of livestock on that land, it is not labeled for that. Now, you know, we keep hearing things that it may be labeled at some point. Being that I work with A&M Extension, great, bring it on. Let's see when it comes. But I will say right now, it's not labeled. As Dr. Hart said, that's a whole new active ingredient, a whole nother round of tests, and a lot more bureaucracy it has to go through.
I'll let you take that one.
I tried to kick that question over here, and they kicked it right back in my face for some reason. I don't know why. So he's asking about the cactoblastis moth. That's what you're asking about. And that is actually, originally, that moth was released in Australia, and it pretty much took prickly pear off the continent, literally. There's hardly any prickly pear in Australia. And some of you are sitting here saying, why don't we get this? Well, because we're too close to Mexico. That's a staple product for food down in Mexico. Nopalitos and the apples, the pear apples, they eat them a lot. My goodness, we even use them for prickly pear margaritas, right? If you never had one, go by our booth and we'll give you one. We've got them there today. So my point is APHIS is not allowing it in right now. We are actually trying to stop it at the Louisiana border because it is in Florida and it's moving this way. So when I say we, I mean we as in the U.S. Are trying to stop it. And the main reason is because that, number one, not everybody wants to get rid of every prickly pear. But at the same time, it's too much of a food crop down in Mexico for it to get down there and be devastating.
There is a native species of that moth, and we see that a lot in our neck of the woods. Usually it does not create enough mortality for us to really get too serious about it, but that's when you do see those sporadic mortality events too. And Dr. Baron Rector, another specialist in our unit, he's currently tracking the introduced moth, and we've got it in several counties down south, like Dr. Hart already said.
There is a variety of prickly pear that's an ornamental. It's called blind prickly pear, and it actually doesn't have spines on it. If you want to grow it on your ranch, you're more than welcome to. But the bottom line is that it is an emergency. It's never used for anything but an emergency food. During droughts, a lot of you guys that are more mature, that have been around for a while, remember the pear burners and all that kind of stuff? And you can get your cows to eat it, but it basically has no value from a nutritional standpoint. It's a filler, and it does cause some internal problems. It causes scours. It causes some other things. And you actually will train your animals to eat prickly pear, and then when you quit burning, they go back to it. And then they start having the mouth problems and all that kind of stuff. So it is... It's not the best alternative, let me put it that way. So.
Okay, we have a question in the back there. Yes, sir.
The compatibility of this product mixing with other chemicals if you were trying to control multi-species. P plus D to control golden wheat in South Texas, in other words.
There's no compatibility issues at all. It'll mix with anything. The only thing we have to be careful of is since this product has aminopyrrolid in it, at 32 ounces per acre, we've maxed out the amount of aminopyrrolid that we can put per acre. So we can't mix it with other products that have aminopyrrolid in them. But P plus D, we can mix it, and it mixes just fine. I'm on the blue. You've been trying for 5 minutes, so I'm going to let you go.
No, not at all.
It's been through EPA. Everything that's in MazeView has been through EPA testing, and believe me, if it had any hint of a carcinogen, we would not get it on the market. It's that simple.
So if you get it on your skin
I'm going to recommend that you use common sense, and if you refer to the label, it's going to say wear long sleeves, but it has no hint of anything that could be carcinogenic.
There's no grazing restrictions. You don't have to move cows out of the pasture to spray it or anything like that. So, there's no restrictions to it. As James says, common sense. I mean, you don't repeated exposure.
Yeah.
You hadn't had a chance yet.
Yes, sir. You know, we have not, and typically once you spray prickly pear, that treatment life is pretty long, so there's really no need that I see to do that. Now, something else to keep in mind, if you were to spray with the Tordon 22K, that's picloram only. That is an extremely slow way to kill a prickly pear. Lots of times it can take up to 3 years to get a good kill with that product alone. So, I'm going to say spray with something, give it time, let it die, and your treatment lifespan is pretty long.
Prickly pear won't build up resistance or anything else like that. So really, you're good to stick with something that works.
Well, I'm told we're out of time. So the questions that are left, if you'll come up here, we'll stay up here and answer your questions. Thank you for your attendance.